Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today's program, Sharon Mears, but Joanna Strober is co-author of this book, Getting to 50-50, but she's in New York helping start something very exciting for children, but that's another program. But I'll mention about Joanna. She's the CEO and co-founder of Curbo Health, an online company creating tools and education to prevent and treat childhood obesity. She has spent her career working as an attorney and as an investor in venture capital and private equity companies and funds. Joanna lives in San Francisco with her husband, Jason, a software entrepreneur, and their three children. She holds a BA in political science from the University of Pennsylvania and a JD from UCLA. Sharon Mears, our speaker today, was the managing director at Goldman Sachs and Company until April 2005, when she decided that it was time to write this book. In her 16-year career at Goldman, Sharon ran several businesses and served on the diversity committee of two of the firm's divisions. Sharon also serves on the board of National Women's Law Center and on the advisory council of Stanford's Clayman Institute for Research on Gender. Sharon lives in the Bay Area with her husband, Steve, a real estate developer, and their son, age 7, and daughter, age 4. Are they still 7 and 4? Oh, this is an old bio. Okay, well, anyway, they're a lot older than this. A graduate of Harvard, she holds an MA in economics from New York University. So without further ado, Sharon.
Thank you, Patty, for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out on a school night. I want to start by sharing a little bit of how we got into writing this book, share some of the lessons we learned, and then the fun part is opening it up to conversation and questions. So I hope you will all join in, write things down, just raise your hands. So how did we get into this? 10 years ago, I was speaking to a class at Stanford Business School. I had two little kids, a working spouse, and a job that involved commuting to New York from here in the Bay Area. So not ideal, but no worse than many fathers I knew. The kids in the class at Stanford, though, were pretty worried about me, and I got some really interesting questions. A young woman raised her hand in the class and she said, "Sharon, aren't you a little worried that maybe you're ruining your husband's career? I mean, you leave him alone with two little children all by himself?" And I said, "Wow, you know, my husband's a pretty clever guy, and he manages this work-life thing better than I do most of the time. He's doing great." Another hand. "Sharon, this is a little awkward to ask you, but how do you feel about someone else raising your children?" I said, I am actually really glad you asked that question, because come to think of it, before I had kids, I would never have known how much I would value having a team in parenting. My husband, my parents, teachers, the people who help us with childcare. I feel like I have more energy to connect with my children than my parents had with me, and I feel lucky that I don't have to do it all myself. But I stepped back from this experience and thought, gee, if these are the questions bouncing around in people's minds, no wonder we have so few women at the top. And I thought, these are really, really good questions, so why aren't we talking about them more? And then I remembered when I myself was a new manager, when I was 30 and single and had no kids, and I saw talented people all around me pulling back from jobs that they really loved because they were so worried that their jobs were incompatible with their vision of a good life. And I wanted to know how to talk to those people about this because I didn't want them to leave. I wanted to know how to help, and I hoped, both for them and for myself, that there really was a way that more of us could excel at our jobs and get home for dinner. So it turns out that more and more of us share that hope. Over 70% of young people today say they want a dual career wife. Pew Research surveyed folks under 30, and it turns out that the vast majority want a partnership where men and women both have jobs and both care for kids. But as much as we may want it, great partnerships and happy families don't happen automatically. So whether you're single and trying to find the right partner, or married with small kids, whether you're in a same-sex relationship or a heterosexual one, whether you're 25 or 45, the core challenge turns out to be the same. How do we thrive? How do we help each other thrive, both at work and in our lives beyond work? So it's hard to fit it all in, no matter where you are in life, but it turns out that there's lots of research and there are lots of kinds of conversations you can have that help more of us find our unique path. For example, in the U.S., studies say that almost 80% of fathers want more time with their kids. And more than 80% of mothers who quit their jobs say they would prefer to keep them. So that begs a question, shouldn't there be some gains from trade? What if we make it possible for men and women to stand in each other's shoes, allow men to work fewer hours, allow women to work more, whether or not they have kids? But to do that, you need to be a little brave. You need to be willing to do things a bit differently to challenge convention. So, writing our book, Getting to 50-50, we went looking for people who did that, and we've actually found hundreds of men and women who are kind enough to share their stories and are doing quite a lot of being brave and changing the way they do things. And from them, we learned four solutions that seem to help a lot. First is get rid of guilt. Second, better habits at work. Third, welcome men to the home team. By that I mean let men play bigger roles at home so women can lead larger lives at work. And the fourth, clear space to connect. Clear our calendars, shelter time, so we actually have time to talk to the people that we care about in our lives. When we do these four things, men and women share experience and it makes families stronger. And it allows all of us to lead happier, more rewarding lives, both at work and at home. And that is what Getting to 50-50 is really all about. So I'm going to share more about these four solutions, the research and the examples and the stories we found that really help. So get rid of guilt. One obstacle women face when reaching higher is this sense of guilt when we do things like drop our kids off at daycare. I get that. But what's comforting is what the research actually says. Research says kids do equally well whether moms work or not. In fact, the largest study ever done on child care and child development was conducted by an arm of the National Institutes of Health, 1,300 kids over 15 years. And it found that children with 100% maternal care fared no better than everyone else. What's more, the researchers were so convinced by their millions and millions of data points across lots and lots of observations, 10 major universities participating, the researchers went so far as to say to the public, please don't feel guilty. That there is no reason, this is a quote, there is no reason for mothers to feel like they are harming their children if they decide to work. Imagine if everyone believed that. I was surprised to learn that for decades, the data has said really conclusively that pulling back from our jobs significantly increases our risk of depression, whether we are man or woman, young or old. And so depression is not good for kids, so retaining some engagement with life in addition to family helps. In fact, there's a very large study, 10,000 women in the UK, who were studied over time, and they found that the happiest mothers, that mothers, in fact, were happiest when they also had a job, even if it entailed a lot of hours, which is sometimes surprising. Best of all, surveys say that the consumers in all this, children, two-thirds of children, feel they get enough time with their kids, and that does not vary significantly whether the mom works or not. But the truly good news in this is the dad part. And I'm so glad to see a number of men in the room this evening. When men are more engaged, really great things happen. In our book, all of chapter 2 covers a range of fascinating studies that show how much we all gain by embracing the idea that men are equally able and sometimes superior parents. Research says that kids get better grades, they behave better with two adults actively involved in a child's life. The Department of Education was very interested to know what really mattered in the outcomes for public school children, so they went and looked at 20,000 kids all over the country, and they found that the single greatest predictor of high outcomes across academics and behavior was paternal involvement. In fact, they boiled it down to dads who went to their kids' school three times a year or more had children who did dramatically better. And that's after for controlling what the moms did. Interesting. So I am not saying that any of this is easy. I find opportunities to feel guilty all the time. The question is whether we should allow guilt to guide how we live our lives or try to find ways to put it aside. And I'll just tell you a quick story of my own. Well, my daughter, Samantha, now 9, started the first grade. Each child got to bring their parents to work to school for show and tell. And my daughter got up in front of the class, and this is how she introduced us. She said, "This is Steve, my daddy. He builds buildings, kind of like an architect. He likes to sing." She turned to me and she said, "This is my mommy, Sharon. She works full-time, she wrote a book, and she never picks me up at school. Smile!" And I tried to smile back. And despite all the smiling, I obviously felt terrible. And I went home with my husband that night, and we all three had a conversation and said, "Look, Samantha, we can't really pick you up from school every day, but there are things that we can do." And so over the years, we have iterated different things, and more or less today, my husband tries to organize his schedule. I try to organize our schedule so that more or less we can get to school, or at least the after-school activity pick up 5:30, 6 o'clock, about three or four times a month. This does not give us an A grade with Samantha. I just like to make clear. But she knows that we try. So there are limitless opportunities to feel guilty. I try to politely decline them. I would encourage all of us to do the same. And I try to take comfort in what I learned writing the book, that it all can turn out quite well with open minds and enough conversation. So this is my favorite. Fortunately, few people have an opportunity to work in places with habits quite this bad. How many people have seen the movie Wolf of Wall Street? Indeed. So you will recall that at the beginning of this movie, young Leonardo DiCaprio is offered a really interesting pieces of career advice about how to excel in his new profession. And what it reminded me of was just how many bad habits get passed off as drivers of success. And for me, you know, I was fortunate to grow up in a dramatically better environment than poor Mr. DiCaprio, but I did grow up around the very traditional view that success requires 24/7, that you need to eat, breathe, sleep, work 7 days a week, shelve family life in order to be seen as a committed employee. But what I've learned is that that may not always be true, And I've started to think about this question of where did I get my ideas about high performance? I am so old that this is what I thought high performance looked like when I went to college. I imagined people hovered over typewriters with, say, a cigarette and maybe a glass of scotch, thinking brilliant, inspired thoughts. But now that I live in California, I think high performance might look like this. You know, Iron Man, green juice, nuclear devices help. But most of the time, I am very, very tempted to think that high performance looks like this, because that is what I see so many clever people around me doing, multitasking on our various different devices, trying to do multiple things at once. But does the constant ping of our email actually help performance, or does it hurt it? A big tech company actually wanted to know, and they hired researchers to come in and IQ test their workers. It turned out they had pretty smart employees, but guess what? When they tested those same workers back at their cubes, deluged by emails and texts and custom ringtones, those same workers tested 10 IQ points lower. They got dumber simply sitting at their desks. So for context, the researchers in this study point out that 10 IQ points, that's a lot to lose. It's 2 times worse than what you lose from smoking pot. So it's something to think about. So if this is not what strong performance looks like, where do we go to find better habits? New research from big business schools says this, that focused, structured teamwork matters far more than hours at your desk, and measuring what matters, be they sales or patient outcomes, allows us to focus our time and achieve dramatically better results. That is certainly what I have learned managing teams in banking and now technology. And the more I embrace those kinds of habits, the better my teams perform. And let me pause for a second to give you a window on this research. So in our book, we describe a big study done out of Harvard Business School where, again, a technology company hired a team of academics to come in and look at 3 outsourcers producing the same kind of software at the same level of quality. They're 3 best, one in India, one in China, one in Hungary. They looked at work hours, team culture, work-life views. Here's what they found. In India, the team was working 12 hours a day on average. In China, 8 hours a day. In Hungary, 10 hours a day. Dramatically different work hours to produce exactly the same thing. Team culture varied from highly individualistic in India to highly centralized in China to just focused on whatever worked for the team, high teamwork values in Hungary. And you saw this then in work-life views. In India, the researchers commented that employees would tell them how important their job was and how, of course, work should come before family. In the Chinese team, the managers would pull the researchers aside and say, you know, we keep this place like a library. It is in lockdown. It's quiet. If people have questions, they come and ask us. They don't bother each other because it's important to us that people be very efficient and go home and get some rest, because that's how we're going to produce the best results. And then in Hungary, it could be all over the place. It could be 14 hours the day of a product shipment, 5 hours the next. No judgment about it. So is this just interesting workplace anthropology, or can it be of some use to all of us? What if I told you that the only thing that these 3 very different teams had in common was one belief? Their belief was that their way of doing things was the only way to produce world-class results. Now, how many of us fall prey to that? I certainly do. What if instead we allowed ourselves to believe, to imagine that there are better habits out there that will allow more of us to both thrive at work and at home? Then maybe we go looking for them. To give you a a feeling of the kind of things we should all be looking at. Here are two examples from our book. IBM did a very large study of their employee base to find out which employees were happiest, which had the worst, the best outcomes, the least work-life stress. And they found a surprising thing, that their happiest workers did two things we often don't think go together. They worked a lot of hours, 50 hours a week and more, and they got home for dinner at least most nights. And what surprises a lot of people is this can apply all the way up the food chain, depending on where you work. There is another large study we talk about in the book about Fortune 500 executives. The study involved over 1,000 people, one or two levels from a CEO. And it found that a third of these executives felt they got enough time with family. They felt they did not have to sacrifice family to work any more often than work to family. When you looked at actually the behavior of these executives, they did only two things that were strikingly different. They worked 1 hour a day less, 5 hours a week less, not much, and they took all their vacations. Very, very small tweaks created really, really different outcomes, which I find inspiring. I hope you do too. So let me now turn to the third solution that we think matters the most in all of this, which is welcoming men to the home team. As much as we women like to say we want help, we often push men away because we think we are superior running our homes. Anyone heard that before? What research says is that when men feel discouraged, they stop offering to help. And they feel discouraged when women insist that the female way is the only way. Research also says that when women are willing to believe that men are equally good parents, those men do more at home. And there is, in fact, no evidence that maternal instinct actually exists. And there's lots of evidence to the contrary, as much as we socially resist it. And let me tell you a little story. One of my favorite characters in the book is a professor at University of California named Ross Park. And he tells the story of deciding to do something about the slew of mothers in his office who like to tell him that her husband just didn't know how to deal with the baby. He decided to go into the rooms of new parents at the hospital and recruit them and conduct a study, and this is how it went. He clocked how quickly the mother or the father could get formula into the baby. You know, he leveled the playing field, you know, only formula-fed babies. And he then also clocked how quickly either parent could get the child to stop crying and go to sleep. Turns out, no male deficit, no female superiority. Men and women were equally flummoxed by their newborns, which I think is really good news. The question is, what do we do after that? So a lot of people ask, well, this 50-50 stuff, it sounds great. Do men actually sign up for it? And my experience is yes, when we talk really differently about what's good for men. Since 1990, the data says white-collar men are working at least 10 hours more than their forebears. And they're also saying, as we discussed before, they want more time with their kids. So if we're to believe that and give men what they really want to thrive both at work and at home, it helps to focus on the ways in which 50-50 helps men. It is clearly just simply good economics. Two incomes are better than one. It's also good for men's careers. There's a lot of research in chapter two of our book about how a second income can free men to go back to school, to change jobs, to start a business. And third, there is a growing body of research showing that it is a man's experience as a parent, not as an employee, not in his career, that is the strongest predictor of his well-being, both in terms of physical health and mental health. And perhaps most exciting of all, 50-50 can be very good for marriage. When couples both have jobs and both care for kids, divorce risk drops by half. That is what the studies say, looking at data in the U.S. since the mid-1980s. Psychologists also remind us that sharing experience creates more intimacy, and that's all very good, even if some of that intimacy involves bickering over who's making dinner tonight. So let me share our fourth and final solution that we heard from happy working parents, because it's particularly hard for me and so particularly useful to me. A few months ago, the New York Times wrote about a study that looked at marital satisfaction across generations, and they concluded that more equal relationships that we are seeing increasingly in the world around us are actually more satisfying when men and women do stand in each other's shoes. But they are only more satisfying when we take enough time to be together and communicate. And that's the hard part. So I clipped a picture that I could put on my desk to remind myself that I need to do this. This picture gave me an image of what I should be trying to do, to clear a space in the jungle that is my life, to push back on all the encroachments, to put up walls, create a little shelter for me and my family to connect. But let me tell you a little bit about three ways we heard other people doing this and what it did for them. So, please laugh. This is a picture from Cosmopolitan magazine. Cosmopolitan magazine was nice enough to write about getting to 50-50. And when my children saw this picture of two people kissing while cleaning a shower, my children said, "Is that what your book is about? Kissing in the shower? I didn't know." So I share it here because about what I'm about to recommend is very unsexy and will not rise to the level of excitement portrayed in this picture. But it is actually quite exciting. It is perhaps the most exciting thing my husband and I have done in our journey as parents after learning this from the people we interviewed. And that is the value of bringing home a very boring idea from work, the weekly one-on-one. One of the people we interviewed actually said, "It is more romantic than roses." Carving out time to talk about the banal necessities of, you know, who's going to pick up Charlie from baseball and how does your calendar look this week and who needs to work late and who needs to travel and when is the school play? These things need to be discussed with the same level of seriousness we discuss them with our colleagues. The happiest couples we talk to really push themselves to clear this kind of space, to resolve the crazy logistics of running a home, and to build bridges when they fall down. How about family agreements? How about writing them down? A man that we interviewed went to great lengths to tell me about his challenges working out with his wife the true meaning of two words, travel less. He said for years and years they had been squabbling. She would say, "Please travel less this year." And at the end of the year he said, "I traveled less, aren't you happy?" And she would say, "No." And they wouldn't understand. So finally they sat down and they wrote this down. And for her, travel less meant fewer interrupted weeks. He'd always thought it meant just take really short trips, which meant he was gone every other day. And so very easily they got to, you know, he should just bunch his travel at the end, you know, one piece of the month and have the other 3 weeks together. That story really spoke to me because I had to realize that no matter how much I love my husband or my children, I have no idea what's in their heads unless I really ask and push, and in our case, write it down. And so, since writing this book, this is the kind of family agreement that we have brought into our lives. We have decided that three things will make a big difference in how we live. We've agreed that there is a dinner time. It is 6:30 at our house until further notice. We've agreed to keep food incredibly simple. Don't be looking for any gourmet meals if you come to us. We also are expected to be there most nights. We have a budget for travel. We try to keep it to 5 nights a month. It could be 10 one month and 2 the next. And then we have agreed that parent email and children's video games are morally equivalent, and they're both subject to what we call the off-switch rule. At 6:30, when it is time for family time, it all goes off and stays off until family time is over, which could be very late at night or exceedingly early in the morning. We have found that so valuable that at the risk of annoying all of our extended family members, we have told them it applies to them, that our kitchen phone also goes off, so if they'd like to contact us, it will be on the weekend or on our commute home from work. Doesn't make us all that popular. So the last thing I'll close with is a story that I got from a person who was an early advisor to this book and has always stuck with me. There was a woman in our book we call Mary, and she was a lawyer who had two small kids under 3, and her husband traveled a lot for business, often 4 days a week. And one night, she said, she was up all night with 2 kids. They were sick, not sleeping well. And she sent her husband a very simple email. It said something like, up all night with kids, this isn't working for me. Any thoughts, solutions? And her husband was game to engage and replied, hey, how about a different way of doing things? What if on Fridays when I get home, we order pizza, I go take the kids, watch a movie, eat, you go hibernate, get some rest, and then you'll be happy for the rest of the weekend, and we'll be happy to see you when you're ready to see us. And the most important thing about this story to me was something that Mary said that has always stuck with me. She said, when men don't notice that you need help, it's not because they don't love you. You can't think that. They were just raised differently than we were. What you need to do is say what you need in a clear and friendly way. I try to remember Mary's words every day. So I'm going to close with a few practical thoughts in the hope that they will be useful to you or useful to people you care about. The overriding advice I give myself and others is to be curious, even nosy, about how other people are finding their way towards thriving both at work and at home. And I'll tell you a story about just how nosy I was as I faced down all of my concerns about becoming a working parent 13 plus years ago. When I was pregnant with my first child, I actually called up a woman I barely knew, and I invited her to lunch. And she was a senior investment banker and was married to a management consultant, and they had 4 children. So I sort of viewed her as sort of the Olympic level of working parenthood. And so at lunch, she mapped out for me, you know, this is just kind of how we do it in our house. And I wrote down every single word. And that became the blueprint for me and my husband to begin a conversation and think about how we would do things. So I think it's so important that we try to be curious with the understanding that no two people are alike and nobody else's solution is really going to work for us in its entirety. But the more we share these stories, the more we make that normal, the more we are likely to hear something that lets us believe that a door could be opened that we otherwise thought was permanently closed. It gives us a sense of greater possibility. And the more talented men and women do these things and share experience and stand in each other's shoes, I believe the more we will have rewarding lives, happier lives both at work and at home, and build together, men and women, a better, more equal world. So with that, I give you 50-50 and look forward to hearing your thoughts and questions.
Just read the questions. Now it's Q&A time, and those are easy to read, good questions, so you can just read those questions out loud before you answer them.
Perfect. Thanks. So one person asks, does the number of kids in a family have any effect on the studies quoted? That is a really good question. And the answer is, I have not seen it broken out as a specific factor. But I think what I certainly saw in the discussions is it really all depends. As we talked to working parents, there were people who did have multiple children and were actually faring very well with it. There were people who had only one child, and that felt somewhat overwhelming. And so I think it goes back to this question of understanding what our children really need from us. And I think getting back to this concept of get rid of guilt so that we can calmly figure out what can fit in our lives so that our children get from us what they really need, and not worry too much about the various different things that society may tell us we need to do that may or may not be important, whether we have a small number of children or many. Another person asks, what do studies say about the age of parents and the ability and success in getting to 50-50. That's a really interesting one. And I guess I just comment on a few things. So there is a lot of research that talks about my son, now 13, has gotten very interested in all sorts of statistics, and he has told me some incredible numbers about how deferring, first of all, completing education, so completing high school and college, improves one's chance of remaining married. And then deferring marriage until age 26 and beyond dramatically increases our chance of staying married. So you know, this many people seem to bemoan this world in which people wait until they're in their 30s to have children and get married, but you know, from my view, from what I've read in the research, I think it turns out to be an awfully, it statistically helps a lot of us. Certainly, I was not prepared earlier in life to do any of this, so lucky for me. But there are actually a number of people in our book who had kids quite young, and for them it worked. It just, you tend to be earlier in your career, and so there's more financial stress and more career anxiety earlier in life. So those are the things that we saw and thought about. Next question. What is the impact on divorce and happiness when women are the breadwinners? So that is a really interesting subject. There are two graphs in getting to 50-50. And one of them is a chart that shows divorce risk against the percentage split of housework and earnings. And this is the study we quote that says divorce risk is halved when husbands and wives equally share housework and earnings. The thing that's a little disturbing for those of us who like a more equal world is that it's skewed. what it shows is that at the extremes where a wife doesn't work at all, divorce risk is higher when a wife doesn't work at all. But divorce risk is even higher when a husband doesn't work at all. And in talking to the researcher who has won a lot of awards for this research, She, you know, says, you know, unfortunately, it's just a mirror of society. We are in a world still where we are more comfortable with men as the dominant breadwinners, and we are less comfortable as a society with women as the dominant breadwinner. But in a future world, we will kill the word dominance entirely. We will just we will both work and both care for kids, as the kids in the surveys that we talked about seem to really want. But until then, there's a lot of advice around. You know, there's a guy named John Gottman who is a very famous marriage psychologist, and he makes a very good point, which is nobody wants to be a servant, even if we love each other, right? Nobody wants to be a servant. So it is a very good thing, no matter who's the breadwinner, to make sure that the other person does not feel that they have value in the workplace. I think it's important to always make it clear that any of us have the ability to be in the workplace, go back to work, have a role beyond family, even if we choose to step back for a while, and that none of us feel like doing the less glamorous stuff around our house is entirely and permanently anyone's job. So I hope that helps. More questions here. So this one says, just to clarify, are you saying that in your home, no one works in the evenings or does email? Ask my children. I'll clarify that. What do you do your weekends look like? How do you balance chores and errands with family or couple fun and bonding time? So fantastic question. Thank you very much. So my daughter has taken to running around the house grabbing the mobile devices of people who defy the off switch rule. I have to say that I am the person who has the mobile device snatched most often. My husband will tell you that too, unfortunately. It's what I'm still recovering from my years as an investment banker. So it is certainly the case that it's sort of like staying on a healthy diet. Do we never eat Snickers bars? No, we eat Snickers bars. But do we know that, as they say in that book, The Zone, you know, healthy eating is a meal away. So every time I break my own rules, I do know that it is in the interest of my family, it's in the interest of me, not to do it again, or at least to try really hard. So what we do, because this is a very important question, I mean, it's not like I work at eBay today. I don't have, an entirely predictable schedule. There are clients and very important issues that come up. So my deal with myself is family time is sacred. If there's something truly cataclysmic, I'll tell the family, I'm sorry, this doesn't work. You know, this is one of my nights away. Sorry. Otherwise, I get up really early. I got used to waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and if I need to, I'll get up earlier. But that, for me, is better than staying up late. Lots of parents we talk about in the book, you know, have different ways of doing it. So I hope that answers that piece of the question. We are not at all perfect. We just try really hard. In terms of weekends, again, you know, for both my husband and I, when we have work to do, the goal is to do that outside of soccer and water polo and, you know, going for a hike with the kids time. And from when work is very intense, we have agreements that say Sunday mornings, our parent catch up on work time. And, you know, there have been years and years when, you know, on Sunday mornings, you know, we'd either be doing the bills or, you know, catching up on work projects, and, you know, the kids would play in the yard or invite a friend or whatever it is. So it would blow up family time from time to time. Right now we're in a bit of a nice pocket where, again, it can be cured by just getting up early in the morning, which has the only negative consequences. I look and feel really tired. But that's the way of the world. So fun and bonding time. that is something we have to remind ourselves to do a lot. But I think, again, for us, strangely, creating all this structure, you know, I never grew up with this much structure. I was a bit of a change in behavior and belief for me to think that somehow structure was going to allow me to have more spontaneous time, but it really, really has. So different people do different things, but that's what's been working for us. So another question. How do we motivate hubby to do weekly one-on-ones? He hates planning. And also, how do you do date night when hubby only wants to be with the kids? I hope I got that question right. This is a good one. This is like... So I guess there's this question of... We got to be on the Today Show 5 years ago, which was really particularly entertaining for two finance geeks like Joanna and me. The thing that the Today Show people said, they took our ideas and put them into much better words. They said, it's all about tone and timing. And I think they were right. It's all about tone and timing. And so I'll tell you a story. One of my husband's good friends from business school is really wonderful, really, really bright woman. And she came up to me once and she said, you know, Sharon, I asked my husband about 50-50 and he said no. And I looked at her and I said, okay, and then what? And she said, well, we didn't talk about it anymore because I thought he would be really angry. And I'm like, I'm really sorry. I'm not trying to cause arguments. I tell this story. There's a psychologist that we quote a lot in the book who I love, who is based here in San Francisco, Dr. Josh Coleman. And he talks about this situation. He talks about how if you can get the tone and timing right, everything changes. That very frequently, because women are brought up to believe that we need to be polite and engaging and avoid conflict, we fail to be persistent with people we love. So he likes to say, be friendly, firm, and immovable. So the answer is no the first time. Then 3 days later, you can ask again. And if that doesn't work, 3 days later, and so on. And so I have to say that in our own family, there are plenty of things my husband and I disagree on all the time and for years at a time. But again, I have tried to take heart from what I feel like I learned from both experts and other parents who are in themselves experts about the importance of continuing to have the conversation. You know, in many ways, it's like in school, you know, some kids learn exactly what's said in the textbook, but most kids don't. Most kids need it said in 3 or 4 different ways, and why should we think that communicating with people in our personal lives is any different? If it doesn't work to say it way one, how about way two, and way three, and way four, and trying it at different times when we are more rested, more happy, that sort of thing. So that is what I would say about getting hubby to do a weekly one-on-one. You might actually ask him how he resolves how you make things go smoothly at the office. The office, we make things go smoothly by talking to each other and by writing down on pieces of paper what went well last week, why did it go well, what went really badly last week, why did it go badly, what can we learn from that? So bringing that home, I think most men, I've never met a man who did not understand that analogy, so I would try that out. And on date night, I think it's interesting that the husband in this case only wants to be with the kids, because I would say, as a rule, I've typically heard that more about moms, that moms don't want to go out on date night because they don't want to leave the kids. So hats off to the dad for not wanting to leave his children. But again, what we talk about a lot in chapter one is, you know, if having a parent at home is not key to having successful children, what we do talk about in chapter one is what the NICHD research says is important to having successful children. And a very key component in that, you know, obviously there are plenty of kids who turn out incredibly well in single-parent homes, but the statistics say that having two adults actively involved in a child's life does make things better, and a harmonious relationship between parents makes a big difference. So taking the time to invest in that relationship matters a lot. And, you know, in our family, my children do complain when mommy and daddy go out on date night. And we actually look at them and say, you know what? This is in your interest. And sometimes they believe us. So, a new question. What is the impact on divorce and happiness? Oh, excuse me. That was a repeat. One more time. Okay, what about personal time? What is personal time? Who asked this question? Here we go. What about personal time? Going to the gym, night out with girlfriends. So I will start by saying my role model, I was very lucky to grow up among a lot of dual career families. I grew up in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. And while my parents had a pretty traditional relationship, a lot of people who were my close friends had parents who both worked. And so I got to observe them growing up, and I thought that was super cool. And when I went to work, my parents had divorced. They had gotten remarried, and my stepmom is a lawyer and a partner at a big D.C. law firm. So needless to say, she worked even more than I did at Goldman Sachs. And she had three kids. And so the beauty that I observed was she was unbelievably good at her job. She was an unbelievably wonderful mother and just stupendous partner to my father, but she had absolutely no personal time. And she manages to get by with a lot less sleep than I do. So it has been a really interesting question, like how do you get away? How do you actually create the time to invest in your own sanity and in your friendships outside of your family? And in the book, there are people who do it much better than I do. But what we have tried to do in our lives is to, again, just try to think our way, iterate to something that might work. So when I left investment banking and stopped having to drive up to San Francisco at strange hours in the morning, and could actually, you know, get up at only 5 or 6 in the morning, my husband and I decided that we would ask our babysitter to come early so that we could run together every morning. So every morning at 6:45, we are out the door and we get to run for 2.7 miles around our neighborhood. And we get back, hop in the shower, and one of the two of us takes our kids to school. So working out became a couple time thing. It was a twofer. And again, in the book, there are all these stories of other people who found different ways to kind of choreograph something that worked. And then interestingly, you know, my husband is a member of the Bohemian Club here in the city, which is still all men. And he has pointed out to me a number of times that he thought it would be very healthy if I had something that was similar. And I didn't know how to feel about that. So I like co-ed. but as it turns out, he's right. And in the last few years, I have actually liberated myself to find groups of women that I can go and hang out with from time to time. It counts against my nights out, so I have to think about, like, is it more important than going to a work dinner? But it really does help, and it's back to, like, how do we share stories that keep us inspired? How do we build relationships and friendships that help get us through all the things that come up in life? So it is important, but hard. So another question here. What about the cost of daycare versus salary? This person points out that sometimes makes it hard to justify working. So I am so glad that this question came up. In the last few chapters of the book, we kind of talk about people kind of as their kids are growing up, and we talk about, we actually quote Kathleen McCartney, who used to be dean of the Ed School at Harvard. She was the psychology professor at Harvard who was the lead researcher from Harvard for the NICHD study. And she actually talks about a lot of really interesting things in the book, but one of them is that first thing to bear in mind is that the best child care is not always the most expensive child care. That what's most important is for parents to understand what they're looking for in child care and go and find child care that works for them. And I'll get to kind of the macro policy piece of this in a moment. But to just give you a flavor of it, some of the best child care in the country is provided by, guess who? The U.S. military. The U.S. military has 100,000 kids in child care every year, and they're in bases all across the country. You don't think of them as sort of like the warm, sensitive grandma kind of types, but guess what? They do a really good job. Child care on U.S. military bases has consistently been rated as above national averages and a pretty good quality. And it's because of standards, very strict, clear standards, and soliciting the right kind of people to be involved. Unfortunately, the kind of ecosystem that the military operates in is harder to replicate outside. But the fact is we do know how to produce quality daycare at scale. We just don't do it because of a lot of the reasons I've touched on. But back to kind of the very personal question, one of the things we talk about in the book is that looking at child care as just relative to your own salary today is, in my view, not the way to do it. Because any couple has decades, if you're having children today, you have decades likely ahead of you of a work life. So if you look at the earnings power of, you know, a husband and wife each earning median income, and you project out what they are likely to earn in a lifetime, you can almost never justify having one person quit wholesale. It will never, while it will feel very painful in the short run to be paying a significant percentage of one person's salary, if you think of it as a percentage of two people's salaries, it gets a little bit easier to think about. And then you look out over the next 10, 15, 20 years, and the cost and need for childcare goes way down, and the earnings power of both people goes way up. So, apologies, I'm a banker by background. If you do the math and bring it forward, it always makes sense for both people to work long term. The trick is getting through it in the short run. And in the book, there are lots and lots of examples of people who pulled in parents, neighbors, aunts, uncles to help defray the cost. They shared childcare with their friends. There's lots of things you could do. We just have to believe that it's worth it. So with that, I think we are at our end. And I thank all of you for all of your great thoughts and wish you luck with all of this in your own lives.
Well, my little speech is gone, so I'm going to have to pretend like I know what I'm saying right now. So it's the three gavel things again. And it's, I can't remember. But that's the end of the program. and thank you very much for joining us here this evening. And thank you very much to Sharon. And her book, by the way, is available out there. Sharon will be here for a little bit. You have a red-eye flight to catch. Do you have time to stop and sign some books? Wonderful. They're 50-50. And what's the subtext? I didn't even bring my book up. There it is, How Working Parents Can Have It All. And I love what she says about excel at your job and be home for dinner. That should be the second subtext. Thank you all for joining us.